Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, February 12th, 2026. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined, Education, Tiny Teacups, Big Manners. John Till's Students Dress Sharp for a Tea Party by Danette Beckett, Decatur. Slices of cheese, crackers, mini muffins, and fruit, all in bite-sized servings, ideal for little fingers, were served to the Johns Hill Magnet School kindergartners for their annual tea party. Dressed in their finest, the kindergartners used their best manners, one of their lesson plans during the special occasion. Maki Daniel wore suspenders for as long as he could. "I already wore these for my graduation," he said about the accessory hanging past his waist. "But my shirt, it's good." The lunchroom was decorated with floral centerpieces as well as white tablecloths donated by the Decatur Club. The children entered under an archway of balloons. According to kindergarten teacher Glenna McKenzie, real glass and china teacups and plates have been used as part of the party since she began teaching 17 years ago. "And we've never broken one," she said. The party was a special occasion just for the Johns Hill kindergarten classes and their teachers. It's a chance for them to get dressed up and use their manners and celebrate their friendships, said teacher Jody Folmsby. Folmsby dressed for the occasion as well, wearing a navy blue velvet dress. "It's a good excuse for us to pull these out of the closet," she said. Kindergarten parents planned, decorated, and served the food and beverages of tea, lemonade, and water. Stephanie McKay volunteered for her daughter Ella's class. "I love that they're doing this for the kids," she said. "They're giving them the opportunity to learn a little bit about manners, and my daughter is so excited about it." McKay said she has witnessed the school provide her daughter with lifestyle lessons. "They are kind of setting them up for success," she said. "They're teaching them things that they may not otherwise be taught." Astair Blickhen donned a white dress covered with small pink hearts. "I wanted to look pretty for my tea party," she said. Manners were important for the event, according to the six-year-old. "Manners are please and thank you," Astair said about the lessons she learned. "They are magic words." After the tea party, the students moved to the dance floor where, according to kindergarten teacher Jessica Cameron, the need for manners is just as important. "We talk about how we stay with our partner," the teacher said. "We use gentle hands, which is something we talk about all the time in the classroom as well." In all environments, the students are taught how to be kind and safe. "We do a slow dance first off," said Maria Diaz, kindergarten teacher assistant. "The slow dance is really where the manners come in. Then the music gets faster. Not that the manners go out the window, but they get to have a little more fun," Diaz said. Four full-color photos accompany this story. The photos are attributed to Joseph Ressler Photos, Herald and Review. The first is captioned, "Thank you," Jada Jackson says to a teacher during the annual kindergarten tea party at Johns Hill Magnet School in Decatur on Wednesday, February 11th. The students learned manners and put them to practice, dressed for the occasion. The second photo is captioned, "Carmela Jack twirls in her dress during the annual kindergarten tea party at Johns Hill Magnet School in Decatur on Wednesday, February 11th. The third photo is captioned, "Cora Houston practices table manners during the annual kindergarten tea party at Johns Hill Magnet School in Decatur on Wednesday, February 11th. And the final photo is captioned, "Aitana Sanchez Banuelos, Hayan Patel, and Remy Robinson arrive on the red carpet for the annual kindergarten tea party at Johns Hill Magnet School in Decatur on Wednesday, February 11th. Decatur Schools Board revisits school tech. Upgrades okayed for teachers. Officials weigh using books over devices. By Valerie Wells, Decatur. members of the Decatur School Board voiced their concerns about the use of technology in the classroom. The discussion during Tuesday's school board meeting was prompted by a vote to upgrade teachers' devices, not the devices issued to and used by students. Mark Reynolds said he worries that the reliance on devices has contributed to a decline in academic achievement. A return to books would benefit students, he added. Board member Karen Lauritsen said she agreed. I'd like to see the district do away with the one-to-one at the student level, she said, referring to the Decatur Schools program that provides devices, iPads for younger students, Chromebooks, older ones, for each student. Kevin Hale said he thought devices should be kept in carts in classrooms under teachers' control and used sparingly, rather than students carrying them around and taking them home. Damage to devices in students' control has cost the district a considerable amount. When the teacher has a project, take them out of the cart, he said. Maybe use technology a little less and get back to old school a little more. Reynolds says he fears that teachers' methodology has changed due to the extensive use of devices as well. And while he agrees that teachers need to use them to a certain extent, perhaps it's also time to take another look at how much they use them. Board President Bill Clevenger said the board should plan to have a fuller discussion on the topic at a future board meeting because the agenda item at this meeting was regarding teachers' devices. The board did vote in favor of upgrading those teachers' devices. In other business, the board rejected a proposed amendment to the agreement between Macon-Piatt Special Education District and member districts, which would increase from 12 months to 18 months the notice required if a district wanted to withdraw. The amendment was proposed to bring the agreement in line with recent changes in state law, and 10 districts have to approve the amendment to make the change. So far, said Macon-Piatt Special Education Executive Director Kathy Horath, six districts have approved and signed the amendment of the 12 districts involved. If four more approve it, the amendment becomes part of the agreement. The Decatur District's legal team recommended approval. Immigration. Lawmakers spar over masked federal officers, by Lisa Mascaro, AP Congressional Correspondent, Washington. Beyond the car windows being smashed, people tackled on city streets, or even a little child with a floppy bunny ears snow cap detained, the images of masked federal officers has become a flashpoint in the Trump administration's immigration enforcement operations. Not in recent U.S. memory has an American policing operation so consistently masked its thousands of officers from the public. A development that the Department of Homeland Security believes is important to safeguard employees from online harassment. But experts warn masking serves another purpose, inciting fear in communities, and risks shattering norms, accountability, and trust between the police and its citizenry. Whether to ban the masks or allow the masking to continue has emerged as a central question in the debate in Congress over funding Homeland Security ahead of Friday's midnight deadline when it faces a partial agency shutdown. Humans read each other's faces. That's how we communicate, said Justin Smith, a former Colorado sheriff who is executive director and CEO of the National Sheriffs Association. When you have a number of federal agents involved in these operations and they can't be identified, you can't see their face. It just tends to make people uncomfortable, he said. That's bringing up some questions. Masks on federal agents have been one constant throughout the first year of President Donald Trump's mass deportation operation. What began as a jarring image last spring, when plain-clothed officers drawing up their masks surrounded and detained a Tufts University doctoral student near her Massachusetts home, has morphed into familiar scenes in Los Angeles, Chicago, and other cities. The shooting deaths of two American citizens at the hands of federal immigration officers during demonstrations against ICE raids in Minneapolis sparked widespread public protest and spurred lawmakers to respond. Cameras on, masks off has become a rallying cry among Democrats, who are also insisting the officers wear body cameras as a way to provide greater accountability and oversight of the operations. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries told reporters at the Capitol that unmasking the federal agents is a hard red line in the negotiations ahead. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says on its website that its officers wear masks to prevent doxing, which can and has placed them and their families at risk. All ICE law enforcement officers carry badges and credentials and will identify themselves when required for public safety or legal necessity. Fueled with funds from the Trump's big tax cut bill, which poured some $170 billion into Homeland Security, ICE has grown to become among the largest law enforcement operations in the nation. Last year, it announced it had more than doubled its ranks to 22,000 with rapid hiring and $50,000 signing bonuses. Homeland Security did not respond to an emailed request for further comment. Most Republicans say the current political climate leaves the immigration officers, many of them new to the job, exposed if their faces and identities are made public. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican North Carolina, said he just can't agree with Democrats' demand that officers unmask themselves. You know, there's a lot of vicious people out there, and they'll take a picture of your face, and the next thing you know, your children or your wife or your husband are being threatened at home, he said. That's just the reality of the world that we're in. It appears no other policing agency in the country regularly uses masking on a widespread basis. Instead, masks are used during special operations, particularly undercover work, or at times during large crowd control or protest situations, and when there is inclement weather or individual health concerns. Experts said only perhaps during the Ku Klux Klan raids or in the Old West has masking been a more widely used tool. It is without precedent in modern American history, said the American Civil Liberties Union's Noreen Shaw in Washington. She said the idea of masked patrols on city streets seeking immigrants can leave people scared and confused about who they are encountering, which she suggested is part of the point. I think it's calculated to terrify people, she said. I don't think anybody viscerally feels like, okay, this is something we want to become a permanent fixture in our streets. Toward the end of the first Trump administration, Congress sought to clamp down after masked federal agents showed up in 2020 to quell protests in Portland and other cities. A provision requiring agents to clearly identify themselves was tucked into a massive defense authorization bill that Trump signed into law. Last year, California became the first state in the nation to ban most law enforcement officers, including federal immigration agents, from covering their faces. The Trump administration's Justice Department sued, saying the state's policies create risk for the agents. Smith of the Sheriff's Association said there's no easy answer to the current masking debate. He suggested perhaps a middle ground could be reached, one that would allow officers to wear masks, but also require their badge or other identifying numbers to be prominently displayed. Advocates said while unmasking the federal agents would be an important step, other restraints on immigration enforcement operations may be even more so. They are pushing Congress to curb the ability of ICE officers to rely on administrative warrants in immigration operations, particularly to enter people's homes, insisting such actions should require judicial warrants with sign-off from the courts. There's also an effort to end roving patrols, the ability of immigration officers to use a person's race, language, or job location to question their legal status, sometimes called Kavanaugh stops, after Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's concurring opinion to a Supreme Court decision last summer. Peoria District hires Decatur school chief by Valerie Wells, Decatur. Mike Curry, who has been Chief Operational Officer for Decatur Public Schools for 4 years, will leave this summer to take a similar position in Peoria Public Schools. Curry's 3-year contract with Peoria was finalized Monday, and he will begin work for them on July 1st. "My 4-plus years here have been amazing," Curry said. "I have worked with an outstanding and supportive superintendent, a great team of supervisors and employees under the extensive operations umbrella, and built positive relationships with several union leaders. I will always be thankful for my time at DPS 61. He has 19 years of experience in education as a teacher, principal, superintendent, and coach, in addition to his work as Chief Operational Officer in Decatur. No announcement has yet been made on when a search for his successor in Decatur could begin. The Decatur District is hitting the home stretch of its search for a new superintendent to replace the retiring Rochelle Clark. School chief may be named by Valerie Wells, Decatur. The Decatur Public Schools Board of Education is nearing a decision on a new superintendent. The announcement could come as soon as next week, Board President Bill Clevenger said Tuesday. He did not provide a date. Superintendent Rochelle Clark announced in October 2024 that she planned to retire at the end of the 2025-26 academic year on June 30th. She has been superintendent since February 2022. Clark said the reason for making the announcement so far ahead of time was to give the board plenty of time to find a successor. The board hired the Illinois Association of School Boards executive search team to assist in that process in August 2025, and interviews have been underway in the last several weeks. The new superintendent would begin work on July 1st. Valentine's Day. Flour imports win over tariffs, rising costs. 400,000 tons of flowers passed through Miami Airport last year. By David Fisher, Associated Press, Miami. Winged babies shooting heart-shaped arrows might get most of the credit on Valentine's Day. But the real magic behind millions of romantic bouquets happens in a cargo warehouse at a South Florida airport. Agricultural specialists at Miami International Airport will process about 990 million stems of cut flowers in the weeks before February 14th, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Around 90% of the fresh cut flowers being sold for Valentine's Day in the United States come through Miami, while the other 10% pass through Los Angeles. Roses, carnations, pom-poms, hydrangeas, chrysanthemums, and gypsophila arrive on hundreds of flights, mostly from Colombia and Ecuador, to Miami on their journey to florists and supermarkets across the U.S. and Canada. Miami's largest flower importer is Avianca Cargo, based in Medellin, Colombia. In preparation for Valentine's Day, the company is transporting about 19,000 tons of flowers on 320 full cargo flights, CEO Diogo Elias said February 6th in Miami. They're running more than twice as many flights compared to normal. "We fly flowers for the whole year, but Valentine's is special," Elias said, "much more concentrated on roses. Red roses, especially. More than 50 to 60% are red roses at this time." Customers buying flowers will likely see an increase in price this year. Christine Bolt, Executive Vice President for the Association of Floral Importers of America, said the cause is largely related to tariffs placed last year on imports from Colombia and Ecuador, along with the new minimum wage enacted this year in Colombia. "This adds significant dollars to the bouquets that are coming in," Bolt said. "Every consumer is going to have to face additional costs." Despite higher prices, flowers continue to make up one of MIA's largest imports, Airport Director Ralph Cutie said. The airport received almost 3.5 million tons of cargo last year, with flowers accounting for more than 400,000 tons. More than a quarter of those flowers are shipped before Valentine's Day, marking a 6% increase over last year. The mother, the wife, the girlfriend in Omaha, Nebraska, that gets their flowers for either Valentine's or Mother's Day, chances are those flowers pass through our airport, QT said, and that's something we take a lot of pride in. Kindergarten readiness split largely on income, by Makia Seminera, Associated Press, San Antonio. Sandra Moscato watched with an amused smile as her two-year-old son, Atreus, began sweeping the floor with a miniature mop. Atreus is part of the inaugural class of infants and toddlers receiving free preschool in a citywide program in San Antonio, Texas. It's something his mother doesn't take for granted. As a child, she wasn't able to start preschool this young. In the case of her two older boys, now in first grade and kindergarten, the free preschool set them up for success in elementary school. The first 5 years of a child's life are among the most critical for their development. Those years lay a foundation and prepare them for kindergarten, often setting them up for success throughout school and beyond. But immense disparities exist in whether parents across the country report their child as ready for kindergarten. New data from the National Survey for Children's Health shows. Nationally, almost two-thirds of children were reported in the survey as on track for kindergarten, regardless of their family's income. However, the gap in kindergarten readiness is substantial when comparing reports from the poorest families and the wealthiest, about a 20% difference. Administered by the U.S. Census Bureau, the federal survey offers a glimpse into school readiness by collecting responses annually from thousands of parents and guardians on their children's early learning, social-emotional development, self-regulation, motor development, and health. The latest results were released in December. Low-income children often have less access to experiences that boost school readiness, such as high-quality early learning opportunities. That isn't to say those kids haven't made gains. Over the past few years, the survey's portion of on-track children from families earning less than the federal poverty line, just under $32,000 for a family of four in 2024, has trended upward nationwide by a few percentage points. Some city and state programs are working to boost that improvement by expanding preschool opportunities for children from low-income families. The mission is even more urgent as parents juggle soaring childcare costs and a widening affordability gap. San Antonio's program called Pre-K-4SA is a prime example. It's designed to serve low-income and working-class families throughout the city, offering 2,000 preschool seats for 3 and 4-year-olds, 80% of them free to families who qualify. The program, which opened in 2013, is funded through the city's sales tax and expanded last year to include 4 infant and toddler classrooms in its new South Education Center. The preschools also offer an unusually broad mix of services in recognition that poverty raises a complex blend of obstacles to kindergarten readiness. Citywide, early childhood programs have also emerged in recent years in Denver, New York, Boston, and Chicago, among others. Students who completed Pre-K-4SA scored higher than the state average on third grade math and reading, according to the Urban Education Institute at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Those outcomes contribute to what Sarah Barre, CEO of Pre-K-4SA, views as a key success of the program. Children with the greatest needs receive the same quality education as kids from wealthier families. The quality is so high that even families who could afford to go anywhere try to get into our schools, Barre said. High quality education. Most experts agree that one of the best ways to boost school readiness is to ensure programs meet high quality standards, such as smaller class sizes and child to staff ratios. Pre-K for SA has implemented a whole child approach that develops a range of skills, including socio-emotional learning. Beret said the program prepares children not just for academic success, but life success. Kids in Desiree Arc's class learn to count and recognize shapes just like other preschoolers. But the children also receive guidance from Arce on social-emotional skills to test out all day, whether it's consoling a crying classmate or resolving a conflict on who sits where at their classroom table. When I see kids that come from, like, where I came from, I'm giving them something that I never got, said Arce, who grew up in a low-income family and has taught at Pre-K for SA for 9 years. Pre-K for SA also intentionally incorporates opportunities for children to refine their motor skills. For lunch, the children in Arce's class pinched turkey burgers, provided by a local food bank, with tongs out of aluminum trays and onto their plates. Exploding ketchup packets were met with celebration as some students opened them by themselves for the first time. Digest. Netanyahu meets with Trump over Iran talks. Washington. President Donald Trump met privately with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday and said he'd insisted negotiations with Iran continue as the U.S. pushes for a nuclear deal. Netanyahu spent nearly 3 hours at the White House, but he entered and left out of the view of reporters, and he and Trump didn't take questions. In a social media post, the president said there was nothing definitive reached other than I insisted that negotiations with Iran continue to see whether or not a deal can be consummated. If it can, I let the prime minister know that will be a preference, Trump wrote. If it cannot, we will just have to see what the outcome will be. Netanyahu's office said the two leaders discussed negotiations with Iran, as well as developments in Gaza and around the region, and agreed to continue their close coordination and relationship. Taxpayer data, wrongly, was shared with DHS, Washington. The IRS wrongly shared the taxpayer information of hundreds of people with the Department of Homeland Security under the agency's controversial agreement to share information on immigrants to identify and deport people illegally in the U.S., according to a court filing. The revelation stems from a data-sharing agreement that allows U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to submit names and addresses of immigrants inside the U.S. illegally to the IRS for cross-verification against tax records. A declaration filed Wednesday by IRS Chief Risk and Control Officer Dottie Romo stated the IRS was able to verify only about 47,000 of the 1.28 million names ICE requested. For less than 5% of those individuals, the IRS gave ICE additional address information, potentially violating privacy rules created to protect taxpayer data. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, February 12th, 2026. Please stay tuned.